Just wish I had it free once.
The van stopped. The man on Farragut's left was tall, and striding out of the van into the yard, threw Farragut to his knees. Farragut got to his feet. He saw the escutcheon for the first and, he thought, the last time. This was where he would die. Then he saw the blue sky and nailed his identity to it, and to the phrasing of four letters that he had begun to write to his wife, his lawyer, his governor, and his bishop. A handful of people watched them quickstep across the yard. Then he distinctly heard a voice say,
"But they look so nice!"
That would have been some innocent, some stray, and Farragut heard a man in uniform say,
"Turn your back and any one of them would put a shiv in it."
But the stray was right. The blue in the space between the van and the prison was the first spread of blue some of them had seen in months. How extraordinary it was, and how truly pure they seemed. They would never again look so well. The light of the sky, shining into their condemned faces, showed a great richness of purpose and innocence.
"They murder," said the guard. "They rape, they stuff babies into furnaces, they'd strangle their own mother for a stick of chewing gum."
Then he turned from the stray to the convicts and began to call,
"You're going to be good boys, you're going to be good boys, you're gonna be good, good boys."
He spread out his call like a train whistle, a hound's belling, some late-night lonely song or cry. They pulled one another up some stairs into a shabby room. Falconer was very shabby, and the shabbiness of the place, everything one saw and touched and smelled had the dimension of neglect, gave the impression briefly that this must surely be the twilight and the dying of enforced penance, although there was a tenanted death house in the north of the place. The bars had been enameled white many years ago, but the enamel had been worn back to iron at the chest level, where men instinctively held them. In a farther room, the guard who called them good boys unlocked their irons, and the deep pleasure of being able to move his arms and his shoulders freely was something Farragut shared with the others. They all rubbed their wrists with their hands.
"What time you got?"
asked the man with boils.
10:15, said Farragut.
"I mean, what time of year?" said the man. "You got one of them calendar watches. I want to know the time of year. Here, let me see it. Let me see it."
Farragut unstrapped his expensive watch and passed it to the stranger, and the stranger put it in his pocket.
"He stole my watch," Farragut said to the guard. "He just stole my watch."
"Oh, did he, Raleigh?" said the guard. "Did he, Raleigh, steal your watch?"
Then he turned to the thief and asked,
"How long was your vacation?"
93 days, said the thief.
"Is that the longest you've been out?"
"The time before last I was out for a year and a half," said the thief. "Will wonders never cease?" asked the guard.
But all of this, all that there was to be seen and heard, was wasted on Farragut, who perceived nothing but paralysis and terror. They were marshaled into a broken-down truck with wooden benches and driven down a road within the walls. At a turn in the road, Farragut saw a man in prison grays feeding bread crusts to a dozen pigeons. This image had for him an extraordinary reality, a promise of saneness. The man was a convict, and he and the bread and the pigeons were all unwanted, but for reasons unknown to Farragut, the image of a man sharing his crusts with birds had the resonance of great antiquity. He stood in the truck to watch for as long as he could. He was similarly moved when, in the building they entered, he saw, high on a water pipe at the ceiling, a tarnished silver Christmas garland. The irony was banal, but it seemed, like the man feeding birds, to represent a grain of reason. Under the Christmas garland, they went into a room furnished with writing chairs whose legs